I'm Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, with hundreds, maybe thousands of things competing to occupy your mind on any given day, writer and artist Jenny Odell urges you to turn away as an act of political resistance. Odell sees human attention as a precious commodity that many of us fail to fully account for and therefore give away without considering the intellectual, emotional, even financial costs. Odell's solution is as simple as it is radical. We all need to learn how to do nothing sometimes. It's also far harder to achieve than it sounds. Our conversation starts after a short break. Walking around in a state of internet-enabled envy, anxiety, and distraction can make us miserable. But it also makes us profitable, a reliable source of revenue to any commercial operation that can command our attention. Our time is money, and we feed that meter every time we pick up our devices, hit refresh, or take the clickbait. We feel compelled to do so hundreds of times a day because we fear missing out. But what are we missing by remaining plugged in for every waking moment? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Artist and writer Jenny Odell teaches at Stanford University. A couple of years ago, late 2016 to be precise, she felt a strange and irresistible call to a public rose garden a few minutes away from where she lives in Oakland, California. Started going every day, or almost. When she got there, she felt compelled to do nothing, at least nothing that could be defined as productive by the 21st century definition. And nothing may be the most important thing she's ever done. She explains all this in her new book, How to Do Nothing, Resisting the Attention Economy. Jenny, welcome to Think.
Hi, thanks for having me.
When you say do nothing, what do you mean exactly?
So I obviously don't mean literally doing nothing. I think I mean nothing by the standards of sort of what we traditionally imagine as productive. So, the example that I give in the book is bird watching. Obviously, bird watching is not nothing, but it is a way that I spend time that I don't really have anything, quote unquote, to show for. It's just for me to be in a place paying attention. It's not about producing anything. It's just about observing.
I like that you say, you know, it's called bird watcher, but you actually prefer the term bird listener.
Or bird noticing.
Uh-huh.
Because, you know, anyone who has gone bird watching or whatever you want to call it knows that a lot of that activity actually has to do with listening. Listening tells you where to look. So it's kind of being aware with all of your senses at the same time.
So what does that do for you, that use of all of your senses when you're not making money or creating something that you can, you know, do something else with?
For me, it just creates a really valuable state of openness. I think that, one of the artists that I talk about is Pauline Oliveros, who came up with this idea of deep listening, which is listening to everything you could possibly listen to, including your own thoughts. And something that she says is that our culture sort of prizes snap judgment or just a judgmental stance toward everything. And the practice of listening is sort of the reverse of that. It's like total receptivity, quieting oneself enough to be able to receive what's actually in front of you. And I personally find that state just, I mean, on one level to be a relief. On another level, it's sort of necessary for me to have a certain type of thought.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm not an artist myself, obviously, but you point out that assigning importance to things that don't have obvious utility or commercial value has implications for a lot of art forms.
Yeah, I mean, art has always been in that category of sort of supposedly useless, or it has a value that can't be quantified or easily demonstrated. But that is in a way like a measure of how valuable it is, right? It's like, if you talk to someone who's made something like a film or a book or a piece of art and they say like, okay, what's it about in one sentence?
Right.
It's like, well, if you could say it in one sentence, you wouldn't have gone through all this effort to make this huge, thing. So I just think that, subtlety and interiority and things like this are sort of underrated, have always been underrated, but I feel like are especially under threat right now.
You write about this magnificent tree in Oakland that's been called Old Survivor. It owes its survival in part to the fact that it did not seem immediately useful to anyone, and so it was spared. What can that tree teach us?
I think it teaches us how narrow our idea of usefulness is, and as well as our definition of productivity. Something that I ask a lot in the book is productive of what, or useful for what. So, you know, if we were all algorithms, right, that optimized ourselves for productivity, we just wouldn't sleep, or we would figure out ways to not sleep. And don't get me wrong, there are people who are actively trying to figure out ways to not sleep and develop drugs for not sleeping and study other species that sleep in different ways. And so that's, you know, very telling. But things like sleep are a really good example of areas of space or time that we sort of take for granted or don't understand that they have a value that is just like not something we can articulate in a super obvious way.
So there's pressure to show that we're productive, but it's surprisingly hard for many of us to do nothing. When offered the time and space to do nothing, we can't stand ourselves. Why is that?
I don't know. I mean, I think that one reason birdwatching has been useful for me is because it's not about me. Mm. And so, you know, I was just talking to someone earlier about how she finds meditating so difficult. I'm terrible at meditating, like by the traditional definition of meditating, like sitting in a room with my eyes closed. But, you know, sitting outside and just kind of staring at a tree or a bird is very easy for me and very absorbing and doesn't feel difficult. It feels, I just feel curious, you know, and that's something that we all remember, at least from childhood, is being so curious and absorbed in something that you can't actually be distracted from that. So, you know, there's a lot of writing about how to use your phone less, and there's a lot of apps for that, and that's all great. But for me, it's like I'd rather than, you know, putting all this effort into trying not to pay attention to this one thing, it's like I'd rather just pay attention to something else.
Yeah, it's funny that we talk about kids' attention spans. I was thinking about when I was 7 or 8, I got obsessed with finding a four-leaf clover, like it was all I wanted in the world. And I would spend, I feel like, hours throughout the summer, like just sitting in a patch of grass, you know, picking through these patches of clover to find, and once or twice I actually did find one, but it was a lot of effort for a little reward.
Yeah, that's so beautiful. and, you know, as a visual artist, I have a lot of work where I kind of sympathize with that impulse because, you know, I've made work where I look, you know, I scour Google Earth for like hundreds of swimming pools or parking lots and then spend hours and hours cutting them out. So it's really kind of the same.
Yeah.
Same impulse.
So we should be very clear here. You are not anti-technology. You're not even anti-social media. So how do you make decisions about the extent to which these things can be part of your everyday life?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think for me, the criteria is sort of, is it opening me up to the world more and connecting me to other people in a genuine way, or is it shutting me off? So I have this really didactic slide that I show in my design class sometimes where I show, you know, someone using you know, one of those apps that lets you identify constellations and they're sort of looking through the screen at, you know, at the sky and learning about it versus a bunch of people playing like Angry Birds on the SF Muni, which is like, you know, the same device, very different uses. And so, you know, over the years, I've been trying to collect examples specifically to show my students of uses of technology that open us up, that kind of actually give you more access and information to what's in front of you. My go-to example is always the app iNaturalist, which is basically like Shazam for plants. and you can just take a photo. It's very good. You can take a photo of a plant or, you know, if you're lucky, a bird. And it'll give you a pretty good guess based on where you are and what time it is. And then someone else will usually confirm it. And that's, you know, if you saw me doing that on a hike, you'd be like, oh, how sad that person is looking at her phone on a hike. But I'm actually engaging, you know, more deeply with what's growing there than I could otherwise.
It's interesting that there are some tasks that we do, you know, if you get really busy cleaning something, you know, and you're kind of focused on that, it can use all your energy, but your mind's able to wander. But so many phone apps, your mind is completely absorbed and you can't think about anything else except, you know, keeping that dot from rolling off the screen or whatever it is.
Yeah, it feels claustrophobic to me. I've thought about it a lot when I literally live in an apartment that I looked at because on Craigslist it was listed as a walker's paradise. It's like it's kind of in a hilly area, so you can get lots of interesting perspectives.
It sounds like a euphemism, actually, like a walker's paradise.
Yeah, totally right. It ended up not being, weirdly. It just really was really nice. But, you know, the number of times that I have just been kind of in the state that you're describing, like deep into some kind of like
internet wormhole, or not the good kind,
right?
Or just kind of like deeply stressed out about something that feels like very, like the loop is very short and it's very close to me, like close to my face and like close to my brain. And then I just kind of leave. I'm like, I have to leave now. Like, even though I don't really understand why in the moment, I'm like, I just need to get out of this right now. And then, you know, after about half an hour, an hour of walking, it's like just amazing how much my mindset has changed and how much more open everything feels.
Yeah. The other mistake that you remind us we might be making is that we feel like, okay, you know, when I go to New Mexico next summer, I'm going to really connect with nature. And you feel like we don't have to leave even urban environments in order to have these kinds of experiences.
Right. And I realize that I'm very privileged and that I live in Oakland, and, you know, Oakland has a, you know, an insane amount of biodiversity and just like, you know, so many. I never go bird watching because as soon as I leave my apartment, I might see. I've actually the most exciting bird sighting I've ever had was on my street.
Oh,
so, and I never saw it again, which is like part of the magic of it, right?
Hmm.
But yeah, I think that there's a risk in kind of like compartmentalizing these different types of perception. Like, oh, when I go to Yosemite, I'm in the wilderness and
right.
it's beautiful and I'm going to take this like Ansel Adams photo. And then you walk outside, you're like, oh, it's just my street. Well, like literally, I mean, depending on where you live, some of the species of trees might actually be the same.
Right.
Of course, they were planted. But I just think that kind of close perception that we have in places like parks and museums should really be something that we practice all the time.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. All right, let's talk about what made you realize that you needed to have daily experiences that were removed from the attention economy. What was it about late 2016 that caused you to feel like you needed to start getting away from too much information?
So there were a couple of things. One was the election and just the way information was, like the rate of information, the rate of the news cycle. Just kind of, I felt like I was seeing a lot of people almost abuse themselves with information.
Mm.
And so that was happening. And then we also had the ghost ship fire here in Oakland, which was a warehouse fire that a lot of people, especially artists and community minded people, were all there and passed away. So, we were sort of reeling here. I specifically felt like I was reeling, and, I was also observing a lot of fellow artists and writers and other kind of makers feeling paralyzed and then feeling guilty about that, like feeling like you need to say something, that you need to say something right now, and not really taking that time to sort of rest and reflect and heal and talk to others in kind of closed contexts.
So what was it about the Rose Garden that felt like an antidote to all that?
It's quiet. That's like the main thing. You know, it's quiet. It's a public space. I contrast it in the book with kind of faux public spaces, or like kind of
like Starbucks.
Yeah, Starbucks. Or I talk about City Walk,
mm-hmm.
Which is sort of like a faux urban environment. This is, you know, it's a city park. It's a public space. It doesn't demand anything of you. I see people going there for all different kinds of reasons, spending different periods of time. People just use it in very different ways. People seem to move slowly there, is something I've observed. People literally stop and smell the flowers. I have probably talked to more strangers in that park than I have anywhere else. And that's not, you know, a lot of the time, but it's just this kind of like leisurely, quiet space of reflection and contemplation and kind of wandering. I think the architecture of the garden is really important. If you go to, you know, the typical rose garden is just a square with rows of roses. This one is sort of more meandering. It has different sections. It's almost has some labyrinth-like sections, and also just like wilder areas with oak trees and lots of stuff like that. So it's really beautiful.
My guest is writer and artist Jenny O'Dell. She teaches at Stanford and has a new book out called How to Do Nothing, Resisting the Attention Economy. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. Thank you. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, and my guest this hour is artist and writer Jenny Odell, who teaches at Stanford University. Her new book is How to Do Nothing, Resisting the Attention Economy. If you'd like to join us to ask a question or to tell us how you do nothing, you can drop us a line on Twitter at KERA Think, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. Another thing you say about doing nothing, Jenny, is that it offers an antidote to the rhetoric of growth. It's so fascinating that we hear so much about growth. We measure it every day in economic terms. We don't very often ask, is that really good for us? Is it what we want? Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. So I'm from Silicon Valley. I grew up in Cupertino. I now teach at Stanford. So I'm very steeped in this is specifically Silicon Valley idea of growth, which is like, you know, when I step back from it even a little bit, it's like you can't like grow exponentially forever anything. Mm-hmm. Like it just doesn't make sense. And yet there's this expectation that, you know, on a quarterly level, like you're expected to show a certain amount of like growth of results. And so that's like a structural thing that is very common, you know, kind of underwrites everything here and like kind of the way that people think, I think. And so for me, I kind of like to counterpose just even ideas of like things like maintenance, or just care, things that are cyclical that don't necessarily produce anything that we would call new. Hmm. And I honestly was inspired just by sitting in the Rose Garden and watching, how many volunteers spend, you know, so much time there doing this work that, you know, they... Sometimes people will come up and say, like, thank you for doing what you're doing, you know, because they enjoy the Rose Garden so much. But otherwise, it's just this kind of effort that you have to put in, you know, month after month, year after year, especially in the winter when there are no roses. Hmm. So there's like sort of nothing to look at. And yet you see all of these people working so hard to make sure that, you know, everything comes back in the summer, and just maintaining the space for others.
The other thing about growth is that it's driven by novelty. And novelty is one of those things that gains a hold on our attention every time.
Right. Yeah. And I think that has to do with the shallowness of attention as well. Something that I talk about in the book is this idea from the William James psychology book that there is actually no such thing as sustained attention. There's just bringing your attention back to the same thing over and over again. And in order to do that, it's actually on you to find something new about that thing to sort of substitute that need for novelty. So I think a lot of the practice of cultivating attention is learning how to find those new angles, you know, whether that's on the everyday or something that you kind of thought you knew. There's always something you didn't know, especially about the things that you thought you knew.
We always tend to be certain that it's never been this way before and no generation has had to deal with this. You remind us that back in the 4th century BC, Epicurus was like really worried that the world was moving too quickly and everybody was sort of losing focus on what was important. What was his solution to that? What did he try to do?
He, speaking of gardens, started a garden school that was sort of away on the outskirts of the city, very sort of inward, not engaging with the rest of the city. And so it was free. It was also the only school to admit slaves and non-Greeks at the time. And they would basically just grow vegetables and like chill out and talk about the Epicurean philosophy, which was basically freedom from a troubled mind. And a troubled mind, in Epicurus's view, came from superstition, kind of like needless worry, chasing after things you can never have. And so I was really drawn to that story because I saw, you know, this I was inspired by this figure who kind of looks around and sees craziness and is just like, wait, let's do something else.
Thomas Merton thought that any removal from society to sort of contemplate the state of the world and of ourselves would inevitably lead us back to the world with a different sense of an obligation of how we could make things better. How does that idea play out in your life?
For me, that's really kind of a mindset that I live in. It's, you know, it's a hard time to be alive for a lot of people to different degrees for different reasons. And I think, you know, a lot of this book is just me trying to figure out how to be okay enough right now to do something ultimately, you know, after you do nothing. And so I like the sort of formulation that Thomas Merton comes up with, which is, yes, you must stand apart from the world to a degree so that you can get a perspective on it and sort of get outside of things like public opinion or maybe social customs that don't actually make a lot of sense, which is what Diogenes was doing. But then at the same time, you can't just forsake the whole thing altogether, because that, you know, is impossible and also unethical. So it's kind of like, how do you back away while still holding your gaze on this world and not giving up on it and imagining how it could be different?
And sometimes it's as simple as just not being at the center of every scene that we enter. Here's David Foster Wallace speaking at Kenyon College in 2005.
And if I don't make a conscious decision about how to think and what to pay attention to, I'm going to be pissed and miserable every time I have to shop. Because my natural default setting is the certainty that situations like this are really all about me, about my hungriness and my fatigue and my desire to just get home. And it's going to seem for all the world like everybody else is just in my way. And who are all these people in my way?
And he follows that up with a really different perspective. Can you kind of paraphrase that for us, Jenny?
Yeah, it's sort of this, I think he calls it the subsurface unity below all things, that you could, that if you make a decision to hold your attention in a certain way, that you can actually experience something like this horrible grocery store situation as sacred almost, that you can sort of remember that we're all here together, and we don't know why, as I quote from the piece of art that we have on our wall in my apartment. So yeah, it's a sort of, again, you know, getting out of that claustrophobic mindset and realizing like, hey, you know, there are other people here. There are other, you know, there are animals here. There are other things growing here. I am just one part of this big, you know, swirling mass of life. And you know, that is actually a relief to me personally, to just sort of realize that and realize that you're part of something. It's not all about you.
All right, let's talk about work for a minute. Very many of us are employed in jobs that seem to to actively discourage thinking, right? You want to look busy, you want to be at the office, you want to send off an email at 8 o'clock at night that shows you're still working. How did this happen?
I think that it's been a long process of deterioration of the idea of the 8-hour work week, which or work day, which I talk about the history of the push for the 8-hour work day over the 20th century and continuing. You have like loss of protections for workers. You have deregulated markets. It's just sort of the social contract between the employer and the employee is sort of it vanished to the point where now it's like every person is basically an entrepreneur. Every person has 24 potentially monetizable hours that they can decide what to do with. And if you fail, it's your fault. There's no real safety net to catch you at that point. So I think it's all sort of underwritten by fear. And I think that fear is justified. If you have a fear about making a living, that's very hard to argue with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was thinking about, you know, for some reason, people driving by a construction site absolutely hate to see a construction worker like, you know, working on the city streets or something, not like actively wielding a shovel or doing something. And I was thinking maybe sometimes they need to stand back and say, okay, is this looking right? How do we solve this problem or whatever? But like, we have no tolerance for the idea that everyone needs to think about what they're doing.
Yeah, everyone needs to think. Everyone needs to rest. I mean, we're animals. Like we have a biological need for rest and a psychological need. I recently heard about this phrase, the wrong mountain problem, which is where you spend so much time climbing up the wrong mountain that you don't realize you're on the wrong mountain. And so it's like, you know, obviously you need time to just look around and assess, and you make an evaluation and have sort of critical thought with yourself, but also with others, and think about, you know, whether you're really applying your energy in the most meaningful way.
So this book is not a how-to book. I mean, it says how to do nothing, but it's not like you give us a series of steps. But have you found a way to advocate for this kind of time in your own life when someone else is in a position to tell you what to do?
It's really hard, to be honest. Yeah. I'm realizing that I have to take a very protective stance toward my time, which, you know, I wish it wasn't like that. I wish that time wasn't money. Yeah. It's actually something I'm sort of researching now. It's like, how did we get to time as money? And that's a really long story. But, you know, here we are, time is money. So you know, things like doing nothing are going to feel really expensive, and you feel like you're taking on an expense when you take a day off, right? And so I'm kind of just trying to unlearn that feeling. And then also just like literally, you know, it's depressing that I have to do this, but put things in my, like put nothing in my calendar. Like we're at the point where I have to do that. Like I can't, you know, just decide. I mean, I do often just like stop doing my work and, you know, go for a walk and procrastinate. But I guess, you know, it's just, it's led to the sort of, yeah, protective feeling about my time and space, and that if I don't actively defend those things, then I won't have them.
Do you have like a code that means nothing in your diary in case someone picks it up? Or do you just put, you know, this is my time to contemplate or walk or whatever?
It's actually on Google Calendars. I have a special color. It's just gray.
Huh.
It's just a gray bar. It doesn't have anything in it.
There's a certain irony to the fact that, you know, I mean, we don't have necessarily the same amount of time to live, but each of us has the same amount of hours in every day. And yet it tends to be wealthier people who have the luxury of controlling their time more than people with lower incomes, even though, again, we all have the same 24 hours every day.
Yeah, that's something I'm very, very concerned about. And I talk about it a lot in the conclusion, where I think that the idea of the attention economy is very much bound up with ideas of public space. And, you know, the fact that you have usually more parks and wealthier parts of a city, not to mention people living in the hills, typically, who have more access to open space. So I sort of pose this potential risk of gated communities of attention, which is where, yeah, you have some people who are able to enjoy the fruits of contemplation and others who just can't. And so something that I'm kind of interested in pushing for is, you know, for anyone who has a little bit of margin to step away and think a little bit differently, you know, and I recognize that that's a luxury that I have, that we use this to kind of concentrate and pay attention together in order to find ways to open up that margin further down the line.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. All right, let's go to the phones now. We have Scott calling from Coppell, Texas. Hi, Scott.
Hi, my question is, it sounds like you're a professor at Stanford. My question is, at a high-power place like that, do your college or other professors spend time like sitting in silence like it sounds like you do? That's my question. You should know that.
Are you asking if other people sit in silence the way Jenny sometimes does?
Yeah, the people at Stanford, at a high-power place like that, are professors.
Thanks for calling.
That's a good question. I don't actually know, but I do have my students do this. So I have an assignment where they sit somewhere for 15 minutes. It's actually, the assignment is based on a piece by Georges Perec, the French author, where he sits in the same place in Paris several times in a row and just writes down everything that happens, almost like a police blotter. And so I have them do that somewhere, specifically around how people are interacting with their devices. And they always come up with the most interesting observations, just like the way, like things like posture or, you know, someone like trying to do something on their phone and literally walking with their laptop open in their other hand. And so it's this kind of exercise in, you know, it's not doing nothing, but I'm asking them to kind of sit and be receptive and just observe.
So it's kind of a pitched battle we have with the digital world if we want to have our, you know, control over our own attention. You include this little chart in the book of techniques that web and app designers use to capture and hold our attention. It's incredibly effective, but pretty stunning what they do, like on any given web page. Can you talk about some of those?
Yeah, so that's actually from a master's thesis from someone at Stanford who was working with the Persuasive Design Lab. I believe that's what it's called. And it was it's an amazing sort of cataloging of all of the elements of persuasive design in the LinkedIn interface. And persuasive design is just anything that is trying, you know, it's persuasive. It's trying to get you to stay on the platform and to engage more. So, you know, classic examples are like a little red thing in the corner that has a number and it gives you some sort of satisfaction to make that go away. Mm. Or little pop-ups that say, hey, there's something new over here. And really, like, once you start paying attention to that stuff and you keep an eye out for it, you'd be amazed at the diversity of techniques that that they've come up with to kind of keep your attention, keep a hold on your attention.
So what are we not paying attention to when these devices and apps have our attention?
I think for me, the most important things that we're not paying attention to are ecology and history, those kind of layers of reality. So, you know, the loop is pretty short, as I said, when you're in this kind of mindset. And it's so easy to just freak out about everything that's happening right now and then freak out about everything that's happening 5 minutes later and then 5 minutes later. And it's really easy to forget that a lot of the things that we're rightly very concerned about have roots in the deeper past than maybe we realize. So things like, you know, the fact that everyone, it's sort of a commonplace that everything on the internet is fake. Well, it's like, you know, you read a book about the history of fraud, it's like you see these patterns going way, way, way back to like P.T. Barnum. So I think there's a risk of kind of not looking at this, you know, amazing accumulated body of knowledge that we have and using that to kind of apply to the present. And then I think we're also missing out on just simple awareness of where we are, of what, you know, grows and lives in the places where we are. So that's kind of the reason I get into bioregionalism in the book. And I, for me personally, it's been really, really meaningful to feel like I participate in a more than human community. It gives me a sense of place and grounding that really I haven't found anywhere else.
So we just have a few seconds before we go to break, but will you first just give us a definition of bioregionalism?
Yeah, bioregionalism is just sort of an awareness of, you know, native plants or animals that live around you, the ecological patterns, just like knowing the place well and committing to stewarding it. So things like permaculture are a really great example of bioregionalism.
My guest is artist and writer Jenny Odell, who teaches at Stanford University and has a book out called How to Do Nothing, Resisting the Attention Economy. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or find us on Twitter at KERAThink. Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with artist and writer Jenny Odell of Stanford University about her new book, How to Do Nothing, Resisting the Attention Economy. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. So you told us what bioregionalism is before the break. What are some ways that we can apply like a bioregional aesthetic to our relationship to what's around us?
I think really the first step is just awareness. I already mentioned the iNaturalist app. So that's, you know, one easy way to just start, you know, going around. Maybe there's a tree you've passed every day and you don't know what it is. That's one really easy way. Obviously, you know, in different places there are native species and non-native species. So a lot of it is just kind of figuring out what, you know, you're never going to get to the original character of a place, but kind of getting a sense of what generally the native species are. And so that's, you know, that's one way. I have found participating in groups to be really great. So I took a bird watching class in January that was amazing. Things where you go on trips with other people, you know, and someone's an expert, but everyone is excited about the same thing. That's a really, really great way to move around, you know, maybe a space you've been before, but paying attention to a totally different thing. And I think when you pay attention to something with other people, it really makes that feel a lot more real.
Hmm. All right, let's go back to the phones. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. Joni is calling from the Woodlands, Texas. Hi, Joni.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to ask your guest if she has any insights into the 5G technology. From what I've heard of it, it will provide internet service to those of us who have opted out. I don't have a computer in my home, and I use a flip phone by choice and never have had a computer in my home. And, you know, it's worrisome to hear about this new technology that's coming out that will provide it for even places that haven't had that option to opt out.
Hmm. Well, I mean, I guess you could still opt out, but what do you think is going to happen when 5G is everywhere, Jenny?
I'm honestly not sure. I mean, I think I mean, it does seem like the idea of complete coverage is, at least even on a metaphorical level, a bit worrying, right? Because it's like nice to, the idea of going off the grid is a, you know, to me, I experience that as a relief. At the same time, I would say, you know, there's a couple of parks that I like to spend a lot of time in here in the East Bay, and one of them doesn't have reception and the other one does. And you would think that I would sort of experience them differently, but I actually find that I don't, because I am in the same state of mind in each place. I just don't, I'm just not engaging with things online anyway. And so, I mean, it's, you know, it definitely could be concerning, but I think that even it would still be possible to kind of take on the mindset that, removes oneself a little bit, just kind of internally.
Joni's question also brings up the idea that we, there is kind of a presumed obligation once we have this technology that we will be available to people. So, yeah. Like the cell phone, I think it seems so intrusive sometimes because you can be driving in your car, you can be at work, you can be, you know, running errands or whatever. And people expect you, if you have your phone, to answer it or to call them right back at the very least. And I always... like, I don't feel an obligation to do that. Like, if I had been not home before, I wouldn't have received the call. But now it's almost like we can never escape connectivity.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny that on my website it says I may take up to a week to respond to email. Like, it's funny that I even have to write that, right? Yeah. Or that I feel apologetic about that. But yeah, you're absolutely right. And something that I mentioned in the book is when I used to work at a corporate job, we had something called results only work environment, in which there was, in theory, no 9-to-5. As long as you got your work done, it didn't really matter like when or how you did it. You could work from home. And in a lot of ways, it's really, you know, great, especially if you're trying to do something else at the same time. But I didn't have an iPhone at the time, and I put off getting one because I sort of saw that the combination of this and the idea of email on a phone would equal me being answerable to something work-related all hours of the day, and I just couldn't accept that.
So the idea of disconnecting occasionally, you know, I think everybody pays it lip service, and yet if you were to, you know, hold people's hearts up to a polygraph and it were, could be accurate, I think a lot of people don't want it. Like, they know they're supposed to want it, but they don't. We're not comfortable with the idea of not having something to occupy us. Can you offer some ways that we can get more comfortable with that?
Yeah, I mean, I think honestly, it just comes back to curiosity. I think it's really natural for us to get fixated on things. Mm-hmm. So maybe it's just a question of what you're fixated on, and the scope of what you're fixated on, and whether or not it's good for you. You know, again, for me, it's birdwatching because that's what I am curious about. I think everyone, you know, has or can find something that is absorbing in that way to them, something that connects them to the places where they are, other people. I think, you know, you can't expect to remove something and replace it with actually nothing, just as, you know, the nothing in my book is not actually nothing.
Right.
You can't disengage your attention from something and not engage it with something else. So I think the idea of not being able to kind of sit with, like, you know, literally do nothing, you know, the fact that that feels difficult is very common. I think it makes a lot of sense. I do think that there is some room for learning to sit with one's own thoughts, because I have personally noticed that the times I was most susceptible to things like persuasive design were when times when I was feeling indecisive or insecure, worried about something, couldn't make a decision about something, and couldn't really sit with that indecision. And it was sort of like I would rather do anything. My brain would rather do anything than sit with that. So some of it is just learning to sit with those thoughts. And I think that might be one of the reasons, you know, to go back to Pauline Oliveros, deep listening has been so useful to me, because it's not just about listening outward, but it's also about listening inward.
Talk a little bit about inattentional blindness.
Yeah, so inattentional blindness is a form of bias that I kind of talk about in the book on both the literal and a more metaphorical level. So one of the examples that I cite is an experiment where people basically don't see things flashed on a screen unless it says something like your name or has a smiley face. And so kind of this experiment proved that a lot of information is making it into your mind or into your brain, and it's But it may not be admitted into consciousness unless it feels relevant. So it kind of just gets at this question of what you do and don't see. I think we've all been surprised by, you know, having someone point out something that was right in front of us, maybe something we walked by every day. And you're like, wow, I pointed my eyes at that, but I just didn't see it at all. So that would be inattentional blindness. And the sort of practices of attention that I'm advocating for in the book are pushing against that and kind of trying to find where your inattentional blindness is. And there's been, you know, lots of amazing work that I talk about in that chapter around that, like the Prejudice Lab, as well as kind of more visual scientific examples.
How has all of this changed the way you relate to other people?
I think that I probably assume less about people now. I think it's a very instructive exercise in general to be shown that you were wrong and that you, or not that you were even that you were wrong, there's something you didn't see. So it's the same lesson for me. You know, I have heard bird sounds my entire life. I may not have registered them at all. And then I started to register them. And now I can make out individual, you know, species sounds. And now that I'm here, it's like, I can't imagine how I didn't hear these things as discrete sounds. And so you apply the same thing to other people. It's like, you know, every person is incredibly complex, even if they seem to express themselves in a way that seems not complex. And just like anything else, that requires time. Just sitting with a person or an idea or a place, the longer you sort of hold your attention and stay open, the more is going to become apparent.
Are there people in your life that are threatened by the fact that you're trying to pay attention and be curious about the world and take time to think?
Honestly, no. I find that it's contagious. Huh. So something I've been really surprised by is how many people have told me that they pay attention to birds now because of me. So even my mom. You know, like now when I'm hanging out with my mom, she's like, you know, what's that? What's that sound? What's that sound? So I think if anything, you know, a state of curiosity and paying attention to certain things and pointing out certain things, it sort of naturally spills over into someone else's attention.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. So obviously you can't give us a, you know, catalog of all the birds of North America and their calls, but maybe you can talk about the way that you use your senses and when you get to a place where you decide that you're going to be paying attention or you have the space to pay attention to the birds around you, what exactly are you paying attention to?
I kind of have to pay attention to everything. So, and that's one of the reasons I call it bird noticing mm-hmm. instead of bird watching in the book is, I mean, the way it typically happens for me is, like I said, I have not made a decision to go bird watching. I am maybe on my way to class at school. I'm in a big hurry. I have a bunch of bags. I'm stressed out. And then I hear something and I just stop. And like in that period, I don't think I could even tell you what day it is. It's just everything has stopped. Now I have to, you know, listen more. I have to look into the tree, kind of try to figure out. And I've gotten way better at that, I find, like finding the tiny bird in the tree. And then once you find it, it's like, okay, what is it? How is it behaving? Does it sort of make sense for this time of year? Right now we have a lot of birds migrating through. So there's a lot of exciting warblers and other small little birds that you might not see during the rest of the year. So it's really just kind of stopping and then using like all of your senses and really just focusing in on this one moment.
And how does that moment change the course of the rest of your day? Or does it?
It definitely does. It has that effect of almost like zooming out from your current situation. I think, you know, when you step away or you zoom out or you otherwise, you know, retreat even for a moment, oftentimes when you come back, you see the absurdity of what you were doing. So when I come back to Earth after, you know, this bird has flown away, I'm like, wow, just like look at me right now. I am so like, what is this even about? Like it kind of gives you perspective. And I think if you don't give yourself those moments, like you burrow really, really far into your circumstances and you're not kind of getting that broader perspective.
So do you still feel tempted to waste time and attention on social media? Or are you like now much stronger in your resistance to those addictive technologies?
You know, I would love to say that I am much stronger, but I'm going to be honest. I think I'm maybe a little bit better but I'm way more aware. So even in the moments when I'm sort of not acting willfully, I am also sort of like, again, looking at myself from the outside, like, wow, look at this is so strange. Like, look at me doing this. And I'm sort of more aware of the reasons I'm doing that, like the sort of insecurity or like emotional reasons that I might be doing it. And so it does happen, but it makes it a lot easier for me to stop and sort of walk away. And I try to be forgiving, right? It's like these things are all processes. This, you know, it's not a how-to book. It's also not a quick fix book. And some of it's just committing to this idea that like this is going to be an ongoing struggle. I will need my attention for not just this, but all kinds of other things in my life.
Well, the awareness really is a big deal because, you know, when those apps first came out or that functionality on a lot of phones that'll tell you like exactly how many minutes and hours you spent in any given day, everybody was surprised by what the total was, right? Nobody said, oh, that's less time than I thought I spent on my phone. Everybody was like, oh, my goodness, I can't believe that this much of my time is occupied by this little device.
Right. I think that's actually, you know, it was very helpful. I have kept a journal since I was old enough to write. Terrifyingly, they are all safe. Like, my mom has all of them. So I have, like, a written record of my entire life. Going back through that, it's amazing the things that you see about yourself if you have enough kind of data. I mean, it's not, journals are not data, but I'm able to sort of see these patterns in my life where it's like you see yourself maybe doing the same thing over and over again. It's like a really common thing, right? Or you can see that certain ideas actually formed much earlier than you thought. So I think this ability, you know, however you're able to achieve it, to step outside yourself and kind of observe with the same close observation that you would, you know, observe the outside world, can be really, really generative.
You mentioned earlier that you had that amazing, like, once-in-a-lifetime bird sighting. What was it that you saw?
Oh my gosh, what was it? Now I'm blanking.
What did it look like? Do you remember?
I used to call them McDonald's birds because they have a red head and yellow body and black wings.
Ooh.
Oh man, I can't believe I'm blanking on this. It's a Western something. Someone will know.
Someone will know.
Everybody
can Google it and then immediately get off their devices, right?
Yeah. It migrates through, so it was unusual that I saw it. But yeah, it was amazing.
Artist and writer Jenny Odell teaches at Stanford. Her book is called How to Do Nothing, Resisting the Attention Economy. Jenny, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for making this time for us.
Thank you so much.
You can follow us on Twitter at KERA Think. You can subscribe to our podcast using your favorite podcast app. And also check out shows we have planned in the future at our website, think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.